Close your eyes and imagine a room. Its walls are covered in antique wallpaper, now torn and faded. If you look closely, you can see the outline of a secret door. A door that will open if you are willing to enter. There is a staircase there that descends into the darkness. And at its base, a room filled with terrible wonders. It is a library of mysteries, a catalogue of terrors. The pages of its books are stained with ink, capturing moments of time stained with blood. Its shelves are weighted with stories yet to be told, with the answers to questions that have yet to be asked. Those stories are waiting for you at the bottom of the hidden staircase.
January 3rd, 1935, Robert Lane was driving late one night when up the road he saw something strange. There was a man running down the street. He was wearing an undershirt, a pair of trousers, and shoes. It was the middle of winter, and while it had been mild that day, Robert thought the man must have been cold. The man had spotted Robert and began waving his hands around to get him to stop. The man slowed and walked up to the window. He was out of breath, and he looked disappointed.
I'm sorry, I thought you were a taxi. Will you take me to where I can get a cab?
Robert nodded to the man, and watched as he had walked over and opened the door.
I'm gonna kill that son of a bitch tomorrow.
The man grumbled as he climbed in and shut the door. Robert noticed that the man looked rough. He had a deep scratch on his arm, and it looked as though he was cupping his hand over a deeper wound. Robert drove to the intersection of 12th and Troost, where most of the taxis would be at. The man thanked him and got out, and then he got into a cab and drove off.
January 2nd, around 1 p.m., a man walked into the lobby of the Hotel President. He carried no luggage with him. The man went to the front desk and requested an interior room a few floors up. When he signed the register, he gave the name Roland T. Owen and gave a Los Angeles home address. He paid for a single day. Owen was described as having cauliflower ear. He could have been a professional wrestler or a boxer. He had dark brown hair and a large horizontal scar on the side of his scalp. He looked to have been between 20 and 35 years of age. The clerk gave Owen the key to room 1046. Bellboy Randolph Probst helped Owen to the room, and he noticed that Owen was neatly dressed and wore a black overcoat. Probst and Owen made small talk on the way up. Owen said that he'd been staying at Mulbach the night before, but the price was outrageous. When they got to the room, Probst opened the door. It was a modest room. It measured about 9 feet by 12 feet. The bed was to the right, and a nightstand was to the left with a telephone on top. Next to it was a writing desk and a dresser. Probst watched as Owen took a brush, comb, and toothpaste out of his coat and placed it in the bathroom. Owen and the bellboy left the room together, and after a few moments, Probst noticed that they forgot to shut the lights off or lock the doors and asked to go back. After they locked up the room, Owen left the building and Probst returned to his duties.
Later that day, the maid, Mary Soptic, had returned to work after having the day off. She had made her rounds and walked to room 1046. Before entering, she knocked on the door. When the door opened, she saw Owen and was taken aback. Before she took her day off, a woman had occupied the room. She apologized and said that she could return later. Owen told her that it was all right and he had let her in. He asked her to not lock the door, that he was expecting a friend in a few moments. Mary noticed that the curtains were drawn and that Owen looked like he was worried or scared about something. As she was cleaning, Owen put on his overcoat and walked to the bathroom to brush his hair. Before he left, he reminded her to not lock the door. Mary didn't see him again until after 4 p.m. when she went back with fresh towels. The door remained unlocked. When she entered, the curtains were still drawn and the room was dark. She was only able to see in the room with the help from the hallway lights. Owen was lying on the bed completely dressed. As she was leaving, she saw a note on the desk that read, "Dawn, I will be back in 15 minutes. Wait."
The following morning, Mary headed to room 1046 in order to clean. Assuming that Owen was out, she used her passkey to unlock the door and went inside. She was startled to see Owen sitting in the dark, but she realized that someone had locked the door from the outside. The telephone rang, and Owen picked up the receiver.
"No, Dawn, I don't want to eat. I'm not hungry, I just had breakfast. No, I'm not hungry."
As Mary was cleaning, he asked her about her job. Was she in charge of the entire floor? Was it a residential hotel? She answered his questions, grabbed the used towels, and left the room. Around 4 p.m., she was bringing back the fresh towel from the laundry. She stopped short when she heard two men talking. Instead of letting herself in, she gently knocked. She heard a different voice than Owen's. It was deep and rough.
"Who is it?"
Mary stated that she was the maid and she was bringing fresh towels.
"We don't need any."
Mary was confused. She knew there were no fresh towels since she took all the ones that were in there earlier that morning. But she didn't say anything more and walked away.
Across town, 30-year-old Gene Owen, no relation to Roland T. Owen, came to Kansas City from Lee's Summit where she had lived to do some shopping. She was planning to meet her boyfriend who worked at a flower shop in town. After a few hours of shopping, Jean began to feel ill and did not want to go out that night. She apologized to her boyfriend and told him that she was going to get a room for the night at the Hotel President. Jean arrived at the hotel at 6 p.m. and was registered a half hour later. She was given the room 1048. Unfortunately, Jean did not sleep well that night and later had given this statement.
"I heard a lot of noise, which sounded like it was on the same floor. It consisted mainly of men and a few women talking loudly and cursing. When it continued, I just about called the desk clerk, but decided not to."
Another statement about that night came from Charles Blotcher, who worked the graveyard shift as an elevator operator. The first hours of his shift were busy, but had slowed down a little after one. However, there seemed to be a rowdy group who were having a party in room 1055. Charles had said,
"I took a woman that I recognized as being a woman who frequents the hotel with different men in different rooms. It is my impression from this woman's actions that she is a commercial woman. I took her to the 10th floor and she made inquiries for room 1026. About 5 minutes after this, I received a signal to come back to the 10th floor. Upon arriving there, I met this same woman, and she wondered why he wasn't in his room, because he had always been prompt in his appointments. She wondered if he might be in room 1024, and because the light was on in there, the transom was opened. She remained for about 30 or 40 minutes. Then I received a signal to go back to the 10th floor. I went back and the same woman appeared there and came down the elevator with me and left at the lobby. About an hour later, she returned in company with a man and I took them to the 9th floor. I later received a signal to go to the 9th floor at about 4:15 a.m. and this woman came down from the 9th floor and left the hotel. In a period of about 15 minutes later, this man came down the elevator complaining that he couldn't sleep and was going out for a while."
The woman raised some questions. Was it possible she was looking for Owen in room 1046 instead of 1026? Did she have anything to do with what happened that night in room 1046? No one knew her name, but they described her as about 5'6", slender, about 135 pounds, and wearing a coat of black Hudson seal. Or possible imitation seal. She was noted by the hotel clerk. He recognized her because she was in and out of the hotel at various hours of the night and early mornings. But no one knew the man she was with.
It wasn't until Friday morning that anyone saw Owen. It was a little after 7 a.m. when telephone operator Della Ferguson started her shift. She noticed that on the switchboard that the phone in room 1046 was off the hook. After 10 minutes, the phone was still off the hook. With no one on the line, she requested that bell service send someone up to the room to have the occupant hang up the phone. The bellboy who was sent was Randolph Probst. He was familiar with the room and the occupant, as he was the one who showed him the room when the man checked in. When he got to the room, he noticed a Do Not Disturb sign on the doorknob. He sighed and knocked on the door. There was no response. He waited a moment, then knocked again, this time louder. A response came in a deep, rough voice.
Come in.
Randolph tried the door, but it was locked, so he started to knock again. This time, the deep voice said,
Turn on the lights.
He knocked again, and again, and again. After 8 or 9 times, frustrated, he just yelled through the door,
Put the phone back on the hook.
With no response, he returned to the lobby. He told Della that he was probably drunk and she should wait an hour, then send somebody else up. It was between 10:30 and 10:45 when another operator reported that the phone was off the hook again. At 11 a.m. after the third time, they sent Randolph back to the room. The Do Not Disturb sign was still on the doorknob. After knocking 3 times with no response, he used his key pass to unlock the door and he entered the room. What he saw shook him. In his statement to the police, he stated,
When I entered the room, this man was within 2 feet of the door. He was on his knees and elbows, holding his head in his hands. I noticed the blood on his head, and I turned on the light and placed the telephone receiver on the hook. I looked around and I saw blood on the walls, on the bed, and in the bathroom. This frightened me, and I immediately left the room and went downstairs.
Probst quickly found the assistant manager, M.S. Weaver, and told them about where they were and what he found. They rushed back to the room, but they were only able to open the door about 6 inches. Owen had collapsed and was blocking the door. The police were called, and soon after, Detective Ira Johnson and William Eldridge, along with Detective Sergeant Frank Howland, arrived at the hotel. Around the same time, Dr. Harold F. Flanders arrived from General Hospital. They were later joined by Detective D.C. King. Owen looked as though he'd been tortured. He was restrained with a cord around his neck and his ankles. There were knife wounds that bled on his chest over his heart, and a knife wound that had punctured his leg. His skull was fractured on the right side, where he'd been hit more than once. He had bruising around his neck, which suggested that he'd been strangled. There was a significant amount of blood on the bed, which had splattered on the wall next to the bed. Blood was even found in small amounts on the ceiling. When the doctor arrived, he began cutting off all the cords on Owen.
The detectives asked him who had been in the room with him. Owen, being semi-conscious and barely able to speak, just said the word, nobody. They asked him how he had gotten hurt. I fell against the bathtub, he replied. They asked if he had tried to commit suicide, to which he said no, before slipping into unconsciousness. They quickly got him into the ambulance. The doctor started to examine his wounds and noted that the wounds would have had to have been from 6 to 7 hours earlier due to the hardening of the blood. So it would have had to happen before the bellboy's trip to the room at 7 a.m. that morning. Back at the hotel, the detectives were searching the room for anything that would help them determine what had happened. What they quickly realized is that what they were able to find would not be as telling as what they didn't find. No clothing was found in the room. The closest thing was a label from a necktie. There were also items that belonged to the hotel that were missing as well, such as the soap, shampoo, and the towels. No signs of a knife or weapon were found. The investigation of the attempted murder of Owen soon turned into a murder investigation. On the way to the hospital, Owen had slipped into a coma, and he had died shortly after midnight.
Police contacted the LAPD to see if they were able to get any information on Owen. After searching through their records, there was nothing on him. They then sent his fingerprints to the Justice Department's Bureau of Investigation, which is now the FBI. It was becoming clear that Owen was under an assumed name, because nothing could be found on him. They continued searching Owen's room for any clues. They found 2 water glasses, one of which was broken, but they found small fingerprints, likely from a woman, on the glass. Jean Owen was held for questioning. She gave her statement, and her day's events were corroborated by her boyfriend. She was soon let go. That's when things started to ramp up. A woman called the hotel president, asking for a description of Owen. She claimed he was a man who had lived in Clinton, Missouri. 50 to 300 people came to view Owen's body at the funeral home. One person recognized him. He had given him a ride after seeing him running in the middle of the road.
Robert Lane spoke to the police about that night. He told them that the man had waved him down and needed a taxi. He described what he was wearing and that he was bleeding. Robert was sure that it was the same man. However, police dismissed his story. How could Owen have gotten out of the hotel without anyone noticing him? The story continued to spread, and people began contacting the Kansas City police in hopes to find out if Owen was actually their missing relative. Many didn't give a description, and for those who did, it didn't match Owen. They advised people to start sending photographs to speed up the identification process. Letters and telegrams were sent to police departments across the country to see if he was in any of their records. Nothing was ever confirmed. Police were frustrated with the lack of movement in the case. They wanted one last look at the room Owen was staying in to see if they had missed anything at all. But when they got there, they found that the hotel staff had already cleaned the room.
They remembered a statement that was given to them about Owen staying at a different hotel the night before coming to the Hotel President. The police headed to the Mulbach. After giving the clerk a description of Owen, the clerk really couldn't recall. But when he was shown a picture, he remembered the man. He pulled out the register and found the entry. He remembered the man asking for an interior room a few floors up and showed the police the entry. He had given a Los Angeles home address, but the name he had given wasn't Roland T. Owen. It was Eugene K. Scott! A new search was started. From calling the LAPD to sending more correspondence to other police stations. They still came up empty. The search for any information on Owen was put aside for a moment, and they turned their attention to finding out who the man called Don was. They had many questions. Was he the same man who was in Owen slash Scott's room with the unnamed woman Thursday night and Friday morning? Was he the man that was seen with the working girl wearing a sealskin coat? Was he the man with a rough voice who told the maid through the door they didn't need towels? Could he have been the man that Robert Lane overheard Owen slash Scott say he was going to kill? All they knew so far was that Owen slash Scott was expecting a visitor because of the maid's statement. Many more people came to view and identify the body of the mysterious man.
Ernest Johnson of Kansas City identified him as his cousin Harvey Johnson.
Later that day, Mrs. Anderson, Ernest Johnson's sister, came to confirm the identity. But she said that Harvey had died 5 years ago.
Tony Bernardi of Little Rock, Arkansas came to view the body next. Bernardi was a wrestling promoter and said that Owen Scott had approached him several weeks earlier. He wanted to sign up for some matches. He said that Owen Scott had given him the name Cecil Warner and that he had wrestled for Charles Locke.
The police got a hold of Charles Locke and he came to the station. After looking at some photographs, Charles said he didn't recognize him as someone he had worked with before.
Time went by, but the police were still looking for answers. The case grew colder. 2 months later, they released the body to be buried. It was scheduled for March 3rd. However, it didn't go as planned. Right before he was buried, the funeral home received an anonymous call. The unnamed person requested that the funeral be delayed. The funeral home protested, but the caller said that they would send money for a proper funeral. 20 days later, the funeral home received an envelope containing cash wrapped in newspaper. It was enough to cover all of the expenses. Even though the donor still remained anonymous, the funeral home still reached out to the police station about the situation. The following Wednesday, the Journal Post received a phone call from a woman. She refused to give her name, but she told the paper,
"Roland Owen was not buried at the Potter's Field. Call the undertaker and the florist, and you'll learn that Mr. Owen's funeral expenses were paid, and that a floral tribute was placed on his grave."
So that's what the paper did. They found that the flowers were secured from the Rock Flower Company. It was the same circumstances as the funeral. The money was sent anonymously, and it paid for a bouquet of 13 roses. They went to the grave and located the bouquet. There was a note attached that said, "Love forever, Louise."
The police still searched to find out who Don was, or any information on who Owen slash Scott was. It wouldn't be for another year and a half that the police would get any answers. It was the fall of 1936, when a woman came across Owen slash Scott's picture, that she was sure she knew who he was. It was the son of a friend of hers. Ruby Ogletree explained to the police that she hadn't heard from her son Artemis in 3 years. They shared several letters back and forth, but they stopped coming. She even wrote to J. Edgar Hoover to help find her son. She wrote back and forth with the police for some time. And then, other facts came out. Ruby said that her son was 17 years old and he had a scar on the side of his head, much like Owen/Scott. She told them it was from a childhood accident where he was burned by hot grease. The police also learned that he had stayed at a third hotel, the St. Regis, with a man who could have been the mysterious Don. So, Owen's identity was finally solved. But unfortunately, his murder still remains unsolved to this day. The police still had so many questions. Who killed him? Why was he killed? What exactly happened in room 1046 that night? Was Don the rough-voiced man? Who was Louise? Was she the woman whose voice was heard? Maybe one day this case can be solved. But for now, the mystery of room 1046 still remains.
Well, what did you think of the mystery of room 1046? Will they ever find out who the mysterious Don was? Will the murder ever be solved? Will you come back for another?
The Hidden Staircase is an American Crimecast production. Your librarian is Samantha Taylor. Your guest librarian is Sir Anthony Hopscotch. The voice of Jean Owen, Rosanna St. Clair. The voice of Charles Blotcher was Justin Rimmel of the Mysterious Circumstances podcast. The voice of the unknown man was John Grills of the Creepy podcast. The voice of the unknown woman was Cindy Hallpacker of the Karen and Ellen Letters. Randolph Prost was played by me, Shane Waters. Owen Scott was played by Lucas Strau. Music comes from Podcast Music. Artwork by Angel Lust. To learn more about The Hidden Staircase and its episodes, you can go to accproductions.org. You can also find us at the Hidden Staircase Podcast Discussion Group on Facebook, on Twitter at The Hidden Pod, and Instagram at The Hidden Staircase. To support the show, you can go to patreon.com/thehiddenstaircase. You can also donate at paypal.me/thehiddenstaircase. Don't forget to lock your doors and hold tight to your flashlight.